Thank you very much for coming out this evening. Brilliant crowd, local lad, local following, clearly, and an international reputation. So we're bound to fill the room, but it's really very full. So we better get underway before any more people want to come in. Those of you who've been coming to these lectures now know the score by now. That's to say, all those years ago in 1609, Galileo turned his telescope to the skies. He had to make his own telescope. He had to learn a lot about optics, about glass, about finance, about politics, about publishing, about making a case, getting himself heard, convincing his public about an unfamiliar technology, and so on and so on. A whole story lies behind the astronomy. We hear about the astronomy a lot. It's sometimes interesting to hear all those other stories that lie behind an innovation of that magnitude. And that got us to thinking at the beginning of the history of science that there might indeed be similar stories in modern astronomy. Similarly, we hear quite a lot about the astronomy. How much do we hear about the building and management of the telescopes and the challenges that are involved in those backstories that are full of the same kind of human emotion and so on that animated Galileo and his colleagues and indeed his enemies. I don't know if we've heard anything about enemies tonight. That's usually not what scientists dwell on these days, but certainly, as you all know, it's true of Galileo. So tonight's speaker, as you can see, Roger Davies, Philip Whitten, Professor of Astrophysics in the University of Oxford, is very welcome indeed. I won't spend time on Roger's biography and his links with the Gemini telescopes, because that's partly what we're going to be hearing about in the lecture. What I do want to say is to thank Roger very much for helping me, in fact, put together this series, because I needed an insider in the astronomical community, an eminent insider, to help me find the right speakers. And Roger was very helpful in that respect, for which I'm very grateful. So without further ado, I'll ask Roger to speak on the Gemini telescope.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Jim, for that introduction. I think you will see that there's a range of human emotions in this story. Nobody has yet been tried, but there's time yet. I'd like to just say one thing before I start, which is that this is a very appropriate place, Oxford, to have a talk about the background and history of the Gemini telescopes, because it's the place in the UK that is the centre for the support for the Gemini observatories. And a few people from the Gemini support team are here in the audience, so I'd like to thank them for their continuing work. And it's great to see them here. Okay, so the other thing I want to say by way of introduction is this book by Patrick McCrae called Giant Telescopes, and it's all in the subtitle, Astronomical Ambition, that's a very important word, and The Promise of Technology, that's the other very important word. So that is available on Amazon if you want to buy it, and if it has, or get it out of the library. It's basically, what I'm going to say is a small part of what's in that book, the history of telescope building post-war. Okay, so let's start off. This is what I'm going to cover. I'll say a few remarks about, the first two bullets are about up to about 1990. And then I'll start really into the Gemini partnership proper, forging a partnership, an international partnership. Mirror wars, you can see the very words say to you that there's conflict here, a battle between competing camps. Then, of course, you get to do it, right? When you've decided what you want to do, you have to figure out why you're doing what you want to do, what science are you trying to achieve? What choices does that drive you in terms of technical designs? How do you realise those design choices? How do you actually construct something that costs $100 million and is halfway around the world? And then I thought you'd be interested to see a few of the recent results from the telescope, and I'll make a few final words about where we're going in the future with extremely large telescopes. So here's my opening slide. You'll see lots of pictures of telescopes in this talk. So from 1948 until middle of the 1960s, Astrophysics was dominated by the results from the Palomar 200-inch telescope. That's this telescope down here. Now, sometimes in these pictures, it's not obvious what the telescope is in the picture. So I'm going to point out that this big thing here is not the telescope. That's just the thing holding it up. The telescope is this bit here. So the primary mirror is down here, and it's 200 inches across. So that's 5 meters. That's a big thing. In the 1960s, there were a generation of 4-meter telescopes built. The design was largely created in the United States. They built one in Arizona and one in Chile. The UK share of one was built in Australia. That's this telescope here, the Anglo-Australian telescope. They all are very similar designs, so they all look like this. In this case, this white bit is the telescope. So the primary mirror is down here, the secondary mirror is up here, and it's inside this big dome. This great big horseshoe thing here is just the thing that helps it move around the sky. These telescopes are only driven on one axis, so they point one axis at the north or south pole and drive around the other axis to take out the motion of the sky. That's the same kind of mount that Palomar had. So on the bottom here, I've given you a very quick summary of the history of telescope making up until 1979. 1979 was a very important year for telescopes. Three important visionary telescopes were opened in that year. So Palomar opened in 1948, but actually built in the 30s, has a very heavy, solid, thick primary mirror. So it's 5 meters across and more than a meter thick at the edge. And basically, the whole of telescope building is focused on producing a surface that reflects light, which is extremely thin and is supported by something. And in the case of these telescopes, it's supported on glass of some kind. The amount of reflecting material, aluminium usually, that's on that surface is the same amount of aluminium or less as there is in a Coke can. So the moving weight of these telescopes would be typically 80 or 100 tons. And that moving weight was simply to support a little membrane of aluminium on the surface of a mirror. The mirrors were thick and heavy, several tons, 5 to 10 tons. So the key thing to building new telescopes without spending tons of money is to get the cost of the primary mirror down and therefore get the weight of the primary mirror down. And so there's Palomar with this big, thick primary mirror. So the next three telescopes all decided, they made design choices to try and get the primary mirror to be lighter. The UK infrared telescope on Hawaii has a thin primary mirror. So instead of being sort of 1:5 aspect ratio, like Palomar, it's a 1/15 of its diameter thick. So it's 4 meters across, roughly, and a 1/15 of that thick. It's still driven by this, what we call an equatorial mount, that's what EQ stands for, this mount that only drives one axis. By 1980s, 1979, you're beginning to see computers come in with a power to be able to control not just one axis at a time, but two axes at a time. And Alec Boxenberg covered this in his first talk. Once you can do that, you can drive two axes, and instead of building this awkward engineering, mechanically engineering shaped mount, you can basically put a telescope in a cannon mount and have it basically move like this and like this, which is a much simpler mechanical arrangement. The telescope sits lower to the ground. It makes the telescope mount less heavy and therefore cheaper. So this telescope, the new technology telescope built by the European Southern Observatory in Chile, had that kind of altitude azimuth mount, like a cannon. It also had a thin mirror, like UKurt. And the final telescope on here is perhaps really a revolutionary design. This was a telescope made from 6 1.8-meter mirrors separately, and the light was brought together to a common focus. These mirrors, the 1.8-meter mirrors, were spare spy satellite mirrors. So the University of Arizona that built this telescope along with the Smithsonian Institution had very good links with the military. The military had these spare mirrors, they didn't need them anymore for spy satellites, and they built this telescope around the availability of those mirrors. That's not an untypical story. If you want to build a new telescope, the two things you need are a primary mirror and somewhere to put it, a site. Of course, now what you need is a great huge amount of money. But anyway, so they had six mirrors, they built this telescope with it. And this, on the bottom of this slide, you see basically the kind of options that people were thinking about in trying to make lightweight primary mirrors for telescopes. Okay, so here are some of the cast of characters, and I have to point out straight away here with this slide, I've tried to put a few pictures of people in. These are the prime movers in telescope building and promoting about the time, about 1980. And of course, the pictures, unfortunately, are pictures of them today. So I'm not able to solve that problem. This man was my boss in 1982, Jeffrey Burbidge, when I moved to Tucson, Arizona, to become a member of the observatory staff. And this man, Peter Stripmatter, was the director of the competing institution, and I use that word advisedly, across the road, the Steward Observatory belonging to the University of Arizona. This man, Don Hall, was the deputy director of my institution. He went on to become deputy director of the Space Telescope Science Institute and director of the Institute for Astronomy in Hawaii. So these three guys putting together ideas at the end of the 1970s for big telescopes. Peter Stripmatter proposed a 25-meter telescope. By 1982, by the time I got to Arizona, that aspiration had been downsized to a 15-meter equivalent. And there were two sets of ideas of how to achieve this 15-meter diameter equivalent telescope. One, proposed by the people who built the multiple mirror telescope, and in particular Roger Angel, was to build four 7.5-meter mirrors on one common mount. The other one, proposed by Jerry Nelson at the University of California, was actually already underway. He chose the route of segmenting the primary mirror. So instead of having the primary mirror be a solid piece of glass, he made it out of pieces about 2 meters across that were hexagonal. They put them together in a hexagonal jigsaw puzzle, and that's shown here on the right-hand side. And these two guys are both fantastic physicists. They're in astronomy departments, but they're really physicists. They're really experimental physicists and optical designers. Another interesting thing about these guys is that two of these people are British. Jeff Burbidge was born in Chipping Norton. Roger Angel was born in West London. Peter Stripmatter is Swiss but was trained in Cambridge. And Don Hall is Australian. So in the United States, out of five people who were driving large telescope design, four of them are not American. This is in 1980. Okay, so the 15-meter equivalent was called the National New Technology Telescope. And it was the outbreak of the first round of mirror wars, right? There were mirror wars between Jerry Nelson and the University of California camp and Roger Angel and the University of Arizona camp. And there was a committee of people set up to decide what would happen. Now, which of these technologies would the National Observatory choose to build its 15-meter telescope? Now, Jerry Nelson was fortunate enough that he had a funded project going ahead. W.M. Keck gave $92 million to the University of California in 1982, I think, to build the Keck telescope. And there are now two Keck telescopes on the summit of Mauna Kea. And so his technology was underway and in the proving and so on. Roger Angel, on the other hand, did not have an approved project, did not have money, did not have funding. And it was his technology, the technology of large, continuous, 7.5-meter mirrors that was chosen to build this 15-meter equivalent mirror and telescope. And this was a crucial point, and it was a very divisive point. I was on the committee that decided this. I was the most junior member by some large margin. And it was a very dramatic time. The committee met over 18 months, had 12 meetings. There was lots of to-ing and fro-ing. We had to meet it was a bit like electing a pope. We had to go away to distant parts and meet secretly, and then we could announce the decision in 1984, I think. Okay, so that process is not untypical, right? You've got competing groups with good ideas. The reason it was a difficult choice is that both the ideas were good, right? If you have one idea that's flawed, it's easy to make a choice. You have two strong advocates, brilliant physicists, promoting good technology. Now, this wasn't enough, unfortunately. So we worked on this project throughout the 1980s until 1987, when it became clear there simply wasn't enough money to build a 15-meter telescope. And I was working for the US National Observatory at that time. The National New Technology Telescope plan was abandoned, and a project to build two 8-meter telescopes was adopted in its place. However, so that's half the area, right? You had four 7.5-meter telescopes on this common mount. Now you only need two such mirrors. They actually went up in size a bit to 8 meters, but that's a detail. So the project essentially is halved in scale and separated into two telescopes. However, the National Science Foundation of the United States decided it only had enough money to build one of these, and decided to form or look for an international partnership to bring in people to pay for the other one so they could have two. So, now, what was happening elsewhere at this time? Well, there was a key development in 1987 across in Europe. An organisation which was formed in the early 1960s, the European Southern Observatory, had built an observatory in Chile for the use of astronomers in Europe. The UK had not joined this organisation. You just have to reflect back on what the UK's view of Europe was in the 1960s to work out why. Interestingly enough, the idea of doing this was actually put forward in the 1950s, the late 1950s, and the director of the Cambridge Observatory, a man called Redmond, actually signed the first document that was the intention to do this. But by the time it came around to actually doing it, Britain wasn't interested. So they built, they approved the funds in 1987 to build 4 8-metre telescopes in Chile. So that's putting a marker in the ground, right? This organisation had built only a 3.6-metre telescope in Chile before that and had built this National New Technology Telescope, which opened in 1989. So they approved this money before they saw their technology work. But they were going to do this. The other thing that happened around this time is that every 10 years in the United States, the astronomical community, and now many other communities, although the astronomical community started this, reviews their program and decides what things are going to be top priority. This is always chaired by a very eminent astronomer. This was a man called John McCall from Princeton, and he wrote a report along with huge groups of people, lots of committees, called The Decade of the Infrared, this report was called, and that recommended as a very high priority that the US build an infrared telescope. To advance its astronomical program. So these are contextual things for what happened in the UK. So at the end of the 1980s, a year after this decision to abandon the NTT, lots of people left the US National Observatory, including me. It was a pretty dire time, and I came back here to the United States. I came back to Oxford, actually. And what had been going on here in the UK? Well, as those of you who came to Alec Boxenberg's lecture will have heard, in 1984, The UK opened the William Herschel Telescope, but that's a 4.2-metre telescope on La Palma. It was a great achievement, but we're moving into the days of 8-metre telescopes, so it was one of the later 4-metre telescopes to be built. In the mid-1980s, the Royal Astronomical Society, the governing professional society of astronomy in the UK, did a survey similar to the kind of thing that's done in America. They also came up with the idea that the UK astronomers needed access to an 8-metre telescope in the future. And a millimetre telescope called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope was built in Hawaii. Now, these are two very important developments for the following reason. We built an optical telescope in La Palma based on technology that was driven from the Royal Greenwich Observatory, which was at the time in Sussex. The James Clerk Maxwell Millimetre Telescope was built largely with technology from the Rutherford Lab down the road and from the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh. And it went to Hawaii, where already Edinburgh had been running the UK infrared telescope for a decade. So you can see that in the UK, already you have two camps. You have an observatory in La Palma run from the Royal Greenwich Observatory, and you have an observatory in Hawaii run from Edinburgh. So I came back, I was hired by these three guys here on this picture, who were the large telescope panel, Richard Ellis, Jim Huff, and Mike Edmonds. They hired me back from Arizona to help them to advance this project, before I go to the next slide, I'm going to repeat that, of course, I have to show you pictures of these people as they are now, and they didn't look like this now. And the only slide that doesn't do this is the next slide. So here we are. So this is me on the right, and for those of you who haven't noticed, it's Pat Roach who's sitting in the audience on the left. And to spare any further blushes, I shall quickly do that and that. But anyway, so that's putting us back in the same context as everybody else you've seen so far. So this project was established, and basically what we were told to do was to make a scientific case, forge an international partnership, pick a site, and get funds, make a funding proposal. And so what we had to do was all these things. We had to look at what the science case was and build that. What kind of instruments, what kind of measurements do you need to make in order to do that science? We had to work that out and propose some designs. What kind of telescope design does that imply? How many foci do you need? Where do you need to direct the light? How much do you need to spread it out? What kind of mirror technology are you going to use? That's obviously a very important question. What kind of enclosure design are you going to use? I don't know if you noticed that the two kinds of enclosures, one like a box and one like a dome. Where are you going to put it? How much will it cost? How are you going to justify that cost? How are you going to convince somebody that it's the right cost and not it's not going to end up 10 times more? The most important thing we had to do was to establish an international partnership. Because the one thing I haven't said is that what these guys were funded for, these guys here, was not to build an 8-metre telescope, but to build half an 8-metre telescope. They only had half the funds. We had to find somebody to provide the funds for the other half. Okay, so that was the job. Okay, so here was the choice that we were faced with. I'm going to be pretty brief about this because there's a lot of details here. But the two partnerships that formed up were basically a European one and a North American one. And this is how the partnerships looked at the time. They didn't turn out like this, but this is how they looked. So on the one side, the European partnership, the partner was Spain, and the site was La Palma in the Canary Islands, where the William Herschel telescope was. We were supposed to provide 50% of an 8-metre telescope, and somehow Spain and maybe some other partners were supposed to provide the other half. And there were all kinds of things about, you know, are these sites comparable? Do they provide the right conditions for exquisite measurements that you want to make? And the one drawback of the La Palma site was that in the summer, the wind, high-level winds, blow across from the Sahara, and there's sort of dust comes over high levels in the site and extincts the light a little bit and you know, causes various problems. Whereas the Hawaii site was more preferable. The other big difference was that when you build a telescope in a foreign country, you, generally speaking, may come to an agreement with the host country to say, we will build a telescope here, but because you're letting us build it in your country, we will offer your astronomers a certain percentage of the time of the telescope, and this is known as a site tax. And the site tax, the going rate for the site tax in La Palma was 20%, whereas in America it was 10%. So that means you've got more time, of course, if you go with the North American one. So on the North American side, the two partners were the USA and Canada. Half USA, 25% Canada, 25% UK. The site was, there were two sites, two 8-metre telescopes, and we would only have a quarter share. Now, obviously, it's different having half share with Spain, quarter share with America and Canada. That's different, right? You feel different about that. But the site probably was judged to be better. We did long, complicated measurements to work out which site was better. In the end, we came to the conclusion, I think correctly, that the Mauna Kea site is the best site in the world for this kind of activity. And then there was this lower site tax. So it was a very tight call on the part of the large telescope panel, those three guys and me and Pat and so on. We had to decide what to recommend. And what we recommended was the North American option. And then the sky fell in. So 1990 to 91 was a year of frustration and all kinds of things going wrong. So here we are. Here's a team of negotiators for the North American partnership. I'm on that photograph somewhere. The third member of the team, Keith Raybould, he's in the middle there. You probably can't make him out. But there's a ring, 8 metres in diameter, painted on the side of the wall of the observatory, just by the parking lot in Tucson, where we're having some negotiations. But the problem was that the Research Council rejected the recommendation. They weren't happy, they wanted us to look further into this problem, and there was definitely an undercurrent that, you know, look, you got the wrong answer. You know, you really should have gone with Europe. Right. So even in 1990, that was the government was moving us towards a European construction. So that was the North American partnership. The Americans passed funding in Congress to go with this funding, but they constrained two things, which turned out to be a problem. They wanted half the project, and they wanted the total to be only 176 million. So they only provided $88 million. So this was, you know, so they wanted half, and they wanted 88 million. We underwent negotiations with Spain to try and work out what bits of the project would be done where, and there was always this hint that the Spanish really couldn't provide half, and we had to find another partner. We were undertaking those kinds of negotiations. In the summer of 1991, the sky literally did fall in. The Canadians announced they were withdrawing from the project in the North American Partnership. So, you know, this doesn't get any worse than this, right? I mean, you know, you've selected an option and then a partnership collapses because of money. Only had three quarters of a telescope all of a sudden. Now, over the autumn of 1991, lots of trips to Ottawa, back and forth, cajoling, persuading. They came back in at 15%. The Americans, in a crucial development, as it turned out, for funding, brought in three South American countries, Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, to make up the other 10%. It was crucial because this was what really forged the Congress in the United States' commitment to the funding of this project. They saw it as a way of, you know, building scientific infrastructure in South America, and they thought this would be a good thing for North America to do. So we're kind of stuck here, right? You know, it's clear both partnerships are very fragile at this point. Finally, in 1991, the Spanish option completely collapsed. The man who used to be the head of Clarendon, Bill Mitchell, went on a high-level visit to Spain, to Madrid. He, at that time, was the chairman of the Science and Engineering Research Council. The brief was that the Spanish had said they would pay for 40%. And we would pay for 50%. He knew that. Yeah, that was his brief. And so his goal was to persuade the Spanish science minister to come up with another 10%. And this didn't sound, and he thought he might negotiate a bit as well. So it didn't look too bad. So, and we'd been working hard in the background trying to figure out what each could do and really make this a concrete proposal. And so what happened? He went in private negotiations with the Spanish minister. The Spanish minister told him that under no circumstances would they pay for more than 25%, and that was the end. He just came back. So that collapsed. So in fact, we were in the end left with the North American Partnership, and in 1991 the Research Council approved this. Okay, so now let's get to the real Mirror Wars, as it were. Mirror Wars Volume 2. So here's Roger Angel. And at this point, he hasn't made one of these big mirrors, but let me tell you a little bit about these mirrors. There are two kinds of mirrors on this slide, and they're the only two I'll really talk about, because they're the only two that are relevant. The design of the telescope at this point was using a monolithic mirror, 8 meters across, right? So the segmented mirrors were not of interest. And the European Very Large Telescope, the 4 8-meter mirrors, had chosen something like the bottom, like the picture in the bottom here, a thin mirror. Now this mirror down the bottom here is 20 centimeters thick and 8 meters across. So it's got an aspect ratio of 40 to 1. Now if you take a piece of glass with an aspect ratio of 40 to 1, you can bend it. You look at your reflection in it. It distorts. So this is a crazy idea for a telescope mirror. Why was this feasible at all? Well, it's because the whole emphasis of telescope building had moved away from heavy, stiff structures, which were made heavy so that they wouldn't bend as the telescope moved around the sky under gravity, wouldn't sag. Went away from that kind of idea to the idea that, well, let's try and make it as light as possible, and let's correct for the bendiness. Let's measure how much things bend and make a correction. And this all was possible basically because of advances in IT. Computers became able to, microelectronics were able to measure what the distortions had been, and computers were able to push, make sensors and correct for things. And so these big disks were controlled from the back with lots of actuators that would push and different parts of them to stop them losing their shape as you move the telescope around the sky. And you could model this in a computer and figure out the right thing to do. Now, Roger Angel's technology, on the other hand, had taken the opposite approach. Let's keep it stiff, but let's lightweight that stiff thing by basically drilling out the back. In fact, he made these large mirrors in a mould, and he put various materials in the mould and melted glass so that the glass would flow around the hexagonal cells, and then he had a technique for removing the material of the mould, and he was left with a mirror that was sort of about 80% of its solid weight. So it was a thick mirror, but it was structured. It was structured inside. So it was stiff, but lightweight. So here we have two very innovative ways of making big mirrors. Now, there are lots of advantages and disadvantages to these two technologies, and I don't have time to go into them today. But let's the decision that was made was that the Gemini project would procure its 8-meter primary mirrors from Corning, a commercial procurement. Now, this really caused chaos because, as you can imagine, the North American partner had gone through a process already in the 80s and selected the Angel mirrors for their national program. So now they joined an international partnership, and that international partnership had rejected that choice in favour of a commercial procurement, admittedly from an American company. That was the trick, of course. So Corning is a very large company, billions and billions of dollars company that makes cookware and so on. In fact, it made the primary mirror for the Panama telescope all those years ago. And so they were keen to do this. They wanted to do this because they knew it would be good for their public image. So they were able, they had the resources in engineering and fabrication to back their bid, and the Steward Observatory Mirror Lab just couldn't do that. And so Corning were chosen. The US astronomical community, or factions in the US astronomical community, there is no such thing as the US astronomical community, it's a very broken up thing, but factions in that community reacted very badly to this. They went to their congressman. The John McCall, the chairman of the previous decadal review, was called to Congress. He had to explain what happened. He wasn't very happy. There was a review chaired by a man called Jim Houck at Cornell, which said that this decision should be reversed. And so you can imagine, here we are sitting in Oxford, watching this happen, and we're thinking, well, you know, our project's going down the tubes here, everybody's warring with everybody else, you know, the Americans are half a project, they're not going to fund it. But the board of the telescope stood firm and said, no, we've got a proper process here, we made our decision on technical and commercial grounds, it's our project, which is what we've chosen, it's an American company, and in the end, of course, Corning, being a huge outfit, were able to weather this storm, but it was very troubling waters. Okay, so look, let's get now to what we were trying to do. Why did we want to build a big telescope, and what did we have in mind to do with it? Now, this afternoon, in just preparing this talk, I actually found the scientific case we made, and I quickly scanned through it to see what we'd done. And in fact, what I found, we'd done a very wide-ranging scientific case. And I realised, of course, this was not an accident, it was deliberate. If you're trying to get colleagues to support spending a large amount of money on your pet project, it's a good idea if most of them get something out of it. And so what we did at that time was we made big science teams, and each science team wrote a scientific case about what they would do with this telescope if they had it. And in doing that, of course, they became enthusiastic about having such a thing, and so they supported it. So just to give you an idea, we were interested in the formation of stars and planets. Here is the Orion Nebula. How do stars form? What do they do to the material between stars when they explode and so on? How do galaxies evolve? Galaxies in clusters, high redshift galaxies, galaxies that are merging together like this pair. What about the physics of active galaxies? So, you know, in the centres of many galaxies, there are engines which blow out large, very energetic elementary particles, electrons. These electrons spiral around magnetic fields into big lobes like this and this, and they emit radio waves. So this is the nearest active galactic nucleus. How does this work? What's the physics involved here? There was an idea for, that's called the unified model for how these objects work. We wanted to test that. The chemical evolution of the universe is a fascinating subject. All the heavy elements above helium, with the exception of a few tiny bits of lithium and so on, are formed in stars. As stars use nuclear reactions for their energy source, they build the nuclei in their interiors, and the reason that we have all this heavy element stuff around us, carbon, iron and so on, is that stars distribute that material out into the interstellar medium, and the next generation of stars forms. Understanding this process is a very complicated thing. It's a part, just to make a loop back to earlier, it's something that my old boss Jeff Burbidge played a big part in understanding. And then there's the large-scale structure of the universe. The universe is not filled with galaxies that are uniformly distributed. Galaxies cluster together under their mutual gravity. And you can use that fact to measure masses on very large scales. What is the distribution of mass on the largest scales? What is the universe? At this time, we didn't know whether the universe was open or closed. And so this was still an open question. Could we solve this? So that's the kind of scientific canvas that we were painting and the kinds of proposals we were putting forward. We had to make a number of design choices, and there are a large number of these, so I won't go through all of them. But I wanted to show this slide. I can't remember whether Alex Boxenberg showed exactly this, but this is the William Herschel Telescope, a cartoon of the William Herschel Telescope. And this was in 1988, when the Large Telescope panel set us off doing this work. This is what we started with, because this was the thing that the Royal Greenwich Observatory had just done. And basically, they gave us the papers with all the drawings scaled up by a factor of 2 for an 8-metre, more or less. Now, it turns out this is not a good idea at all. Look at, the good thing about this was a dome, that was great. But look at this telescope. Here, it's pivoted about this axis here. This is the elevation axis, so it pivots like that, and it rotates about this axis here. So it's just the old cannon mount. Very straightforward. But the primary mirror looks a lot, this is the primary mirror here, back here. The secondary mirror is here. So light comes in here, hits the primary mirror, secondary mirror, goes back through a hole in the primary mirror to behind the telescope, or it can be directed onto this platform here, or this platform here. So you've got lots of places where you can analyze the light, different foci. That's a good thing. But telescopes are essentially very simple devices. They have to be balanced, and they have to be balanced about this axis, about this elevation axis. Telescopes are so finely balanced, it's a lovely trick to do. You know, when you work at a telescope, you have lots of people come around, Boy Scouts and so on. You can pick up a Boy Scout with a telescope over, like that, so the telescope's over, pick up a Boy Scout, hang him on the telescope, just tell him to hang on, and the telescope moves, of course, because it's perfectly balanced. You put a Boy Scout on a telescope, the telescope moves. And that always impresses, you know, young people, that it's just a very finely balanced system. But what that means is that if you move this primary mirror down this way, you have to put more weight up here. So you make the telescope heavier. And the only way you could get the light out to these platforms here is to have a long distance here, because it's the same distance, essentially. And what this does is it means the telescope gets more massive, and a lot of weight gets put above the primary mirror. It turns out this isn't good for the imaging properties of the telescope. So in fact, what we did was come up with a revolutionary design. This is the design of the telescope that we kind of landed on. So you can see here the balance point now is here, but the primary mirror is essentially right there. It's immediately below it, right? So you've moved the primary mirror up close to the balance axis, which means that the weight above that axis now can be much less. And you can see this very spindly structure up here holding the secondary mirror. So this was a revolutionary design, and it still is a revolutionary design. With a very high primary mirror, and there's no place to put instruments here. This is not an instrument station, it's just the axis over which the telescope moves. So another choice was to do with the enclosure, another choice to do with instruments. I won't go into those now. Okay, now, so this was now, we're talking about in the early 90s now. This was a time after the Cold War, right? The Cold War finished. Cold War technology was being declassified. One of the major pieces of Cold War technology was image sharpening technology. This is the thing that, you know, when you have a spy satellite, you want to know, you know, whether you've got the Daily Telegraph or the Daily Mail behind your back. And so they built spy satellites to sharpen those images. They built the technology. The technology is essentially a deformable mirror which can correct distorted images and some kind of sensor to determine how much they've been distorted. Now, this kind of technology is called adaptive optics, and in principle, it's very important for astronomy, and it was really, because it wasn't American technology, so this was something we probably would have found harder to get if we'd gone with Spanish, but anyway, this is a little cartoon to show you how it works in a telescope. So let me run the cartoon, and I'll speak to it as we go. So here's the Gemini telescope dome, and we decided to have these wonderful opening sides like this, because we wanted the air to flow through the telescope. And here's the telescope that we revealed. And the great thing about this dome is it disappears entirely. So here's the telescope. And you can see here the primary mirror. That's this silver bit here. Right? The blue bit's the mount. The white bit's the telescope structure. The light comes down in here from a star. You'll see it hit the primary mirror. Here it comes. And then go back up to the secondary mirror and then down through a hole in the primary out the back. Okay, so this comes down to the business end here. We've got four instruments mounted on the back end here. Turn to the right one. Okay, so let's, now, so what we see here, now this is the box that corrects for the distortion of the images as the light passes through the atmosphere. In comes the light, It's diverted into this box, passes through a couple of mirrors, red light's reflected, blue light goes to a sensor, the red light's detected on a camera, and there's the image, rather blurred because of the motion of the atmosphere. Okay, now let's now use this blue light to figure out how much it's blurred by. So here are the, these are supposed to indicate wavefronts. So this is, these are sort of potato chip type things. Now they really should be perfectly flat to get a very sharp image. And this is what you see this deformable mirror does. It makes these wavefronts perfectly flat, and that gives you a perfect image, as you'll see now. Bing, right? Sharpens up the image a lot. Now, the big problem that all telescope makers have faced up until this time is that large telescopes should, in principle, make sharper images. The laws of optics tell you that. But this doesn't work because of the distortion introduced by the Earth's atmosphere. The largest telescope, largest telescope in Oxford, that is limited by optics rather than by the Earth's atmosphere, is less than 10 centimetres across. So, you know, an 8-metre mirror is just, you know, is a light bulb. It's to collect more light. It doesn't improve the angular resolution of the image. It doesn't make the images sharper. This technology would make them sharper, and it's a crucial part of the design of all big telescopes now. And it drove lots of the design. So this is the interface between new technology, what you can do with the science, and how you build a telescope. Okay, so I've given you now all the background. What I'm going to do now is show you what happens when you start to build a telescope. Okay, so this is and I'm going to use the Chile telescope as my example. So this is the Virgin site of Cerro Pachón, 10 kilometres from another observatory, Cerro Tololo, which already existed in the south, so you had a base to work from. And the engineers just sketched a little dome on here just to show you what it would look like. So this must have been about 1991, I would imagine. Actually, it must be quite, yeah. Okay, so that's the first thing you do, right? You blow the top of the mountain because you need a flat bit, right? We're amongst friends, aren't we? Start building things. So here's the enclosure. We decided to build a dome. The dome was procured from a Canadian company, Coast Steel in Vancouver. They built other domes. These clouds are a bit worrying, aren't they? Here we are, look. There's the dome being constructed. And here's the final dome. So this is the dome at Cerro Pachón. It doesn't take long to do this kind of thing. It takes about 18 months to do that, right? So this, you know, this is hard, but it's engineering. It can be done. You get a project manager and a team of engineers, they'll do it, right? So some of the other stuff we've talked about so far isn't like that, right? Okay, now here's the really hard thing, the primary mirror. So there it is, you've seen this before. 40-1 aspect ratio, a team of very proud people from Corning. They were absolutely thrilled to have done this. I mean, it was a fantastic achievement for them. So first thing you have to do, Corning Works is in New York, I've forgotten exactly where, but it's close to the Erie Canal. And you go on the Erie Canal then and end up in the Submarine Seaway, and up the Submarine Seaway out into the Atlantic, and eventually you arrive in Paris. So this is a worldwide activity, right? You buy the mirror in America. It goes to Paris to be polished. Right, so here, this is the polishing factory just outside the south of Paris. It's called Riosk. Here's a group of people. I'm on this picture. I think so is Pat. Yeah, here he is. This is Pat here. Yeah, that's him. This is me. There's a bunch of people here visited this site while the polishing was taking place. This is the polished mirror leaving the Riosk factory. Riosk also did all the mirrors for the Very Large Telescope, the ESO VLT. Next thing, gets on a boat, has to go across the North and South Atlantic round. I guess it went through the Panama Canal, I suppose. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, here it is being loaded onto a boat. And here's the next major obstacle. Now, I've been to Chile many times already by this stage, you know, for observe and so on. And it's quite a dry place. They grow grapes and make nice pisco. It's good, you know, it's a lovely place. But the local farmers got fed up of not having enough water, and they wanted a dam built. And so the politicians decided they'd build this dam, and they had to divert the road. And in order to divert the road, they had to build a tunnel through the mountain. And when they built the tunnel through the mountain, they didn't think, of course, that you would need to get an 8-metre mirror through it. And so the observatory, we had to pay extra money. But fortunately, before they did the job, you know, we paid them more money than they would, you know, in order to make the tunnel big enough for us to get the telescope bits and pieces and the mirror through the tunnel. And you know, the big projects are full of challenges like this. So here's the mirror going up towards, you can see here the existing observatory at Sertololo. Here it is on the roads. Look, it's a desert. Here it is, there's a desert. and here it is arriving at the site where the telescope dome is, and then after a lot of very hard work, the polished mirror has a coating of aluminium put on it, and it's ready to go in the telescope. That doesn't take 18 months. This set of slides here about the primary mirror is a very complicated, long process. The primary mirror weighs 20 tons, right? Its support weighs 20 tons, right? So you've got to, and its support, and its only purpose is to support one Coke can's worth of aluminium accurately, right? So, there's the mirror. Telescope. Now, this is the same trip, this is the same trip that we went to see the mirror being polished at Riosk in Paris. We got on the TGV and went down to past Lyon, down the Rhone Valley, to Le Creusot, where NFM, the big steel construction factory that built the pressurized vessels for the French nuclear power stations. They had a 9-meter diameter milling machine. Right. This is an absolutely fantastic engineering works. Unbelievable. anyway, here they are. They constructed the telescopes in the factory. There we all are. Look, see how there's a bit of scale here. This is one side of the telescope. So this is sort of left-hand side. There's the telescope constructed in the factory. And they even drove the control system and tested the control system here. What was the hardest thing about doing this? Where do you put the base, right? How do you hold it down while you're moving it around? You know, it's really quite difficult finding a stable enough platform. But the amazing thing about this company, heavy engineering company, was they had all this infrastructure in place. That's why they got the contract. Millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars are spent in France, right? Because they have very good engineering. Oh! They paid for us to go on a nice lunch to the local winery. So here's the telescope constructed inside the dome with the mirror in it, finally. Right, okay, so let's look at a few things that the telescope's done. Probably most excitingly and most recently, in the autumn of last year, the first pictures were taken of a planetary system outside our own solar system. So here, this is a rather, bit of a complicated image. The middle of this image has been completely blocked out because it's got a very, very bright star in the middle of it. And very sophisticated imaging techniques have been used to cancel out all the scattered light that would go around it. And you can see here two points of light. Now, over the previous year, images have been taken to make sure that these points of light were actually associated with this star. So, you know, the star moves very slowly through the galaxy, and you can see that. And you see these two points move with it. When the Keck telescope took a complementary image of this, they found a third star here. So here we see a bright star with three planets orbiting around it. Now, this is a young star, only 60 million years old. These planets are not like our planets. They're still hot. So we're seeing this planetary system whilst the planets are forming. Those planets are each, you know, of order 10 times the mass of Jupiter, and they're there are a few tens of astronomical units away from the star. And you can see here on this picture, look, the dates are there are some different dates here, so you can see that the stars have actually moved. So this is a first. The first planetary system imaged outside our own solar system. I just picked a few things that appealed to me and had good pictures. So these are, this picture here is the one taken by Gemini using its adaptive optic system. The previous picture was also taken using this image sharpening adaptive optic scheme. These blue elements, these blue points here on the end of these wisps are emissions of iron, and they are what we call them, bullets fired out from the Orion. This is the Orion star forming region, I showed you that earlier, and this is a part of it blown up to very large scale, and these things are moving at 400 kilometres a second. So something very violent is happening in here. It's part of the process of star formation. We don't really understand what these things are or how they're formed, but they are spectacular objects. And this was taken actually not with a system that just uses stars to correct the adaptive optics, but where a laser is shot up into the sky to provide an artificial star, so you can look anywhere in the sky and use the adaptive optics. I didn't explain very much to you about how that works, but adaptive optics needs the star in the sky to use its phase beacon to get its signal from. When there isn't a star, you can shoot a laser up in any direction and make your own star, but this technology is hugely complicated, very difficult, but works. Here's a beautiful result. This shows you different pictures of different colours of a dust disk around a star, a bright star, Beta Pictoris. You can see it with the naked eye in the southern hemisphere. And it's lopsided, look. And there's a sort of lump here. These long wavelengths, there's a lump, and then there's a lot more emission from this side than there is from this side as you go down to shorter wavelengths, bluer colours. And what this is interpreting at is that somewhere around here, maybe 100 years ago or so, two big lumps of material in this disk around the star collided with each other and produced a lot of small dust material. And this small dust material is what causes all this emission out here. And then I've got two more. Supernova cosmology you may have heard of. So we learnt in the end of the 90s that the universe is accelerating. We learnt that because we measured supernovae in the distant universe and they were a little fainter than we were expecting them to be. And this showed us that the universe is accelerating. Now, this is a very important result and has been followed by all kinds of groups. The Gemini telescopes take the deepest spectra for these kinds of programs, deeper than the bigger telescopes, because they have special instrumentation. So they use their instrumentation in a novel way so that they were actually the telescope of choice for doing this kind of very deep spectroscopic work. Finally, this is the Gemini Deep Survey, never shy of hyperbole. So here you can see very faint objects taken in an image, and here is spectra of those objects, so the light is spread out by different colours. And what this survey showed was that the most massive galaxies in the universe, even in the distant past, have old stars in them. And what that tells you is that the universe, the galaxies don't form in the way that theorists postulate that they form currently, which is that little ones form first and big ones form later. There are a large range of major results that have come out of the telescopes. Okay, so I've almost finished. I have an epilogue here. The UK in Gemini, and those of you, some of you may be aware, certainly all the professionals here will be aware, that at the end of 2007, our funding body, the Science and Technology Funding Council, announced that they were withdrawing from Germany. This was a bit of a shock. I was the UK project scientist, and over the time I was there, I served on the board of the telescope, and I was chairman of the board for a while. I knew nothing about this. So I knew it would be very difficult for them to withdraw, because, of course, I have a copy of the agreement in my drawer. When you write international agreements, you don't make it possible for people to just say, well, I'm giving up. You know, that's not a very sensible way of doing things. But it was a crisis. They had apparently lost £80 million that they were expecting to have. And in the next month, they changed their mind a little bit. It was an outcry. I wrote a paper and a lot of people. So they said, okay, well, we'll just keep the normal, because by this time, the UK had joined the European Southern Observatory, so we had access to other telescopes in the Southern Observatory, need to save money, so this didn't seem like such a crazy plan. But of course, it's not possible. You can't make a unilateral decision like that if you're an international partner in an organisation. So, there's a legal agreement. And so, in fact, in February of last year, that they gave up and said, oh, well, we'll just remain full members until the agreement expires, which is 2012. So the agreement started in 1992 and went for 20 years. And after 2012, it's all up for renegotiation. But this shows you why international partnerships are important in big science. Because governments are volatile things and they're prone to short-term decision-making. And big science doesn't thrive in that environment. The way you organise big science is to be robust against these things. But it really is hard work, and it was a pretty rotten time going through all this. So finally, the future, it's back to our two favourite characters, Roger Angel and Jerry Nelson. Roger Angel wants to build the giant Magellan telescope with six 8-metre mirrors, a 20-metre equivalent area, and Jerry Nelson wants to build the 30-metre segmented mirror telescope. So the same characters with the same technology are going forward to the next generation. This is Europe's project. So they saw a 20-metre telescope proposal, a 30-metre telescope proposal. This is a proposal from the European Southern Observatory for a 42-metre telescope. These are in the study phase at the moment, but the decision as to whether to build this one is scheduled for December 2010. So with that, I'll finish and take questions. Thank you.
One of the themes that Jim has developed during these talks is that in the early days, the scientists had to be their own technicians. Newton ground his own lenses, and Galileo played with his own lenses, and also the technicians, John Dolan, wanted to be a scientist. Now, I'm wondering how that plays out these days. So, if you're building a new telescope, do you go to a bright physicist and say, become an engineer? Or do you go to a bright engineer and say, do some physics with me?
Well, how do you tell one from the other? You know, I mean, I think this is a really, you know, it's a very important question. And, you know, fundamentally, well, for you know, Angel and Nelson are fundamentally just very smart guys who know what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And they just keep going until they get there. In fact, though, you know, so they're individuals, and as individuals, they've made a huge contribution. But, of course, they can't do anything alone, and there are huge teams of people. And so they build, you know, the teams that they build are organised by a manager and a director and so on. And so those individuals are protected from the responsibility of, you know, fiscal responsibility, for example, left with their imagination. They draw in other imaginative engineers. So the trick is to make sure they can have the creative spark and the people around them that will make it work, whilst not loading them up with the responsibility for reporting, governance, accountability and so on. So it's a different world. I mean, you know, it's still the case that these guys attract very creative people around them, but you need a lot more than that to get to the end of a big project like this.
I apologise for asking a naive question, but I found this fascinating. You mentioned about the image correction device that you put in on the light.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a synthetic way of getting a result. How do you know you're getting the right result?
Okay, well, so I'll explain a little more how it works. So the light from a star comes from thousands of light years away, and as the light hits the top of the atmosphere, it's a perfect plane wave. It's just undisturbed wavefront. It hits the last 100 kilometres of its journey, and it's distorted by the density and temperature distribution, the distortions in the atmosphere. And so when it reaches the telescope, it looks like this. Now, you know that the star that it came from is a point of light, right? So you can say, okay, now I know this came from something that really is a point of light. So I now will measure that shape. I won't tell you, I can't tell you how to do that, but there's a way of measuring that shape. I've got my distorting mirror, I can correct for it. If that correction makes the star look like a point, then you know you're close to where you want to be. You go around the loop again and try again. Now, of course, we have some other ways of doing it. We have a telescope above the atmosphere that takes pictures all the time, the Hubble Space Telescope. So, you know, you can see how close you get to things like that. So we have a lot of ways of validating how that image sharpening works. You do have to be careful. There are artifacts. You can be misled. In fact, all this machinery can produce misleading images. One of the science cases that I didn't pick was the disproving of the existence of a galaxy at redshift 10, which turned out to be an artifact in an image, not due to sharpening, but for some other reason. So you do have to be very careful.
Anyway, yes, Roger. Roger, could you say why could Corning, with all their infrastructure and experience, not do the polishing?
There were other companies who could do the polishing. I think the main reason is that because RIOS had done the very large telescope mirrors, they had the support in place on which to place the mirror. Because, see, this very thin mirror The way you polish things is you rub them, right? You rub them, right? Well, of course, if you rub this mirror, it bends because it's so thin. So you have to have a very sophisticated support all the time. And that support has to, you know, it's an expensive thing. And so because they had that, they were just streets ahead. They could do it more quickly and they could do it more accurately and with confidence because they'd done, I think, two or three VLT mirrors first.
Okay, we've got a few now, so I think you at the back were first.
Yeah, you said the mirror surface is aluminium. Do you have problems with the aluminium box that is in?
Yes. Yeah, in fact, the whole business of what to coat mirrors with is really a big research project. So I said aluminium because it's a nice shorthand. In fact, actually, those mirrors, at least were then, I'm not quite sure now, that they were coated with aluminium. But there was a lot of work put in on the Gemini telescopes on mirror coating. Aluminium has some good properties. It reflects down into the UV, but it does corrode. Doesn't corrode as badly as silver, but silver doesn't reflect in the UV, but it's much better in the red. Much better, higher reflectance in the red. The telescopes were really built for red, not for UV. And so actually the aim was to coat the mirrors with silver. Silver does tarnish very easily. You have to overcoat it with something to protect it. You have to develop something that won't distort the radiation as it falls onto it. So what to coat mirrors with is a complicated technology, which is still under development, you know, and it will continue to be under development. You can't. It gets dusty. You try and protect it. So you protect it in a number of ways. First of all, you can kind of keep a positive pressure of air in the dome. You don't do that all the time because you like the air to go through the dome. So, you know, it depends what the wind's like. You saw the dome opens up completely, so the wind can blow through. When the wind blows through, that's good because it flushes the air in the dome, keeps everything the same temperature, which is good for making sharp images. But it's bad because loads of dust comes in. So there's nothing you can do about it. What you do is clean it. And one of the mechanisms they use for cleaning it is to have the telescope horizon pointing, and then they spray it with some kind of dry ice spray. And you know, it basically the dust falls off. Or another method is to use a kind of plastic spray. Spray plastic on bits of the mirror and peel it off. But it is important, and the mirror, of course, needs to be recoated every couple of years. Or even more often, because it does degrade in quality, and it's an important limitation on the reflection, on the reflectivity of the mirror.
That last one, we're going to have that one.
You had a long list of scientific goals at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I suppose my question is, were there things you achieved that weren't on that original list?
Yeah. Well, the real truth is that there are things. Some of the things that were aimed at really came good in the sense that this high fidelity, high angular resolution imaging was a real emphasis in the science at the beginning and a real emphasis in the technology. And as you can see, it came through with these beautiful images of these planetary systems. Other things, though, were sacrificed. So particularly, you know, a particularly difficult thing in the UK was that when we set off to have a telescope which would allow us to have a wide field focus. So, say a focus that you could take a picture of the full moon, roughly. The field of view of the Gemini telescope is very much smaller than that, maybe a tenth or less than that, not about a tenth. But we weren't able to make a telescope of the kind we wanted that would have this wide field focus. So we just didn't do some of the survey science, the science that would look at many objects all at once. That's a lot of sacrifice. So some things were done supremely well, other things were sacrificed along the way.
We heard a similar story last week, in fact, for what we now call the Lovell telescope, having a very long list of possibilities, and I think only one out of their five principal goals was actually came through by the time the telescope was ready.
Well, you should really release Roger. That was absolutely brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. If you enjoyed that, and I know you did, come back next week to hear Alan Watson talk about looking for cosmic rays in Argentina in the last lecture of the series. But for now, thank you very much indeed, Roger.